24. The Report. Around noon on March 22nd, an otherwise quiet Friday in spring, Ed O'Callaghan got a special delivery at his Justice Department office. He was handed a heavy ream of paper bound by a clear plastic sheet on top and a durable black backing. The title, Report on the Investigation into Russian Interference in the 2016 Presidential Election. Robert Mueller had completed his probe, and here were his long-awaited findings, all 448 pages of them. O'Callaghan, Bill Barr, Rod Rosenstein, and Brian Rabbit, Barr's chief of staff, dropped their plans for the day, walled themselves off from others in the office, and started reading. Their first thought was that there were more than 400 pages and Mueller's team had not redacted anything. They instead used footnotes to mark sensitive material learned in the grand jury, but it wasn't clear precisely what Mueller's team felt should be kept secret. The special counsel's team had indicated in the March 5th meeting that they would identify that sensitive information, known as 6E material, which could be a cumbersome process. But Mueller's investigators did not feel it was their role to redact, only to identify the material. Justice Department officials saw this as a failure by Mueller's team to redact as promised, and this critical missing step would make it difficult to release the report quickly to the public. The Barr team's immediate priority was to wrap their heads around what Mueller wrote, so they skipped around the two volumes looking for his conclusions and summaries. Mid-afternoon, they decided they should notify the public that the special counsel had transmitted his report to the Attorney General, so the team drafted a letter to Congress. Barr wrote, "I am reviewing the report and anticipate that I may be in a position to advise you of the special counsel's principal conclusions as soon as this weekend." He also reiterated his intention to make the findings public, adding, "I remain committed to as much transparency as possible." Between 4 and 5 o'clock that afternoon, Rabbit called White House lawyer Emmett Flood to let him know that the Justice Department had the report. He read Flood a draft of Barr's letter to congressional leaders, but did not tell Flood what Mueller's report said or what his bottom-line conclusions were. He telegraphed one bit of good news. Mueller was not recommending any additional indictments. Flood relayed the news to Trump. A few minutes later, Stephen Boyd, the Assistant Attorney General for Legislative Affairs, hand-delivered Barr's letter to Capitol Hill, and it was almost immediately distributed to the news media. The world now knew that Mueller's nearly two-year investigation was over, and his findings were in the hands of Barr. Trump had already left for Florida that morning to spend the weekend at Mar-a-Lago. Flood and Pat Cipollone, believing that delivery of the Mueller report was imminent, accompanied him in case he needed lawyers close at hand and were added at the last minute to the Air Force One manifest for the 10 a.m. flight. But that Friday afternoon, the Trump team could do little but wait on Barr. The president restrained himself from calling his attorney general to find out more, for once following his lawyer's guidance about not communicating with Barr so as not to compromise the independence of the investigation. Trump's team felt confident Mueller could not accuse Trump of any conspiracy to collude with Russians and was on shaky ground to accuse him of obstruction based on the evidence they knew Mueller had compiled. They knew Mueller did not plan to indict Trump, a sitting president, and did not want to risk the negative political implications of preventing the Justice Department from making fully independent decisions. They knew the Democrats would want nothing more than to catch the president interfering with the end stage of the Mueller investigation. In the weeks leading up to this moment, Barr had tried to maintain a healthy distance from Trump. He avoided too many visits to the White House for fear of appearing too chummy with the boss. But although Barr was new on the job, Trump and his team had full confidence in his judgment, in no small part because of Barr's expansive view of presidential power and his June 2018 memo arguing that the obstruction of justice investigation into the president had been fatally misconceived. They also believed Barr had the will to fight to protect the president and his executive authority. Inside the White House, some aides nicknamed Barr the Honey Badger, a reference to a viral video in which a fearless badger climbs a tree to kill a snake, gets bitten by the snake, passes out, and then starts eating the slithering creature. It was always going to be Barr's show, one Trump legal advisor said. Even if we wanted to be a puppeteer, why would we risk it? Emmett was not going to let stupid decisions be made at the end of this game. We were not going to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. On March 22nd, Rudy Giuliani, Jay Sekulow, and Jane and Martin Raskin were scattered around the country, from New York to Nashville, and scrambled to get back to Washington. They gathered the next day in the oversized conference room in Sekulow's law offices on Capitol Hill, an 1880s pharmacy that had been converted into office space. The Maryland Avenue building featured a conference room with a massive mural of Washington. There, Sekulow, Giuliani, and the Raskins prepared for what could come. We felt confident, but until you have it, you don't have it, one team member recalled. All of them agreed there could be no finding that the president had engaged in collusion with the Russians. But they remained concerned about the other half of the probe. They thought it was possible the report might claim that Trump had broken the law, and that the president would have been charged with crimes but for the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel policy prohibiting prosecution of the president. The team did not like that scenario, but if Mueller were to accuse Trump of crimes, the president's team had planned a counter-narrative. "We didn't know how obstruction would happen," the team member said. "We thought they might lay out the facts. We just didn't know how." Inside the special counsel's office, Mueller and his prosecutors eagerly awaited the debut of their investigative findings and the breaking of a sacred silence the team had maintained for the past 2 years. Finally, the copious evidence they had combed the globe to gather would be released in some form to the public. But the prosecutors on the team didn't know how much Barr would ultimately decide to share right away, and they anxiously discussed what he might do. In preparation for this moment, the two main teams, one working on Russian interference, the other working on obstruction of justice, had written the report with overarching summaries, which they hoped would give Barr something easy to share with the public before releasing the full report. They felt, at a bare minimum, he would release those. The 448-page report was a breathtaking catalog of presidential scheming and misconduct. Volume 2 detailed 10 events that the special counsel scrutinized for possible obstruction of justice by Trump. It was not just a historical record. It also provided a dense legal analysis of the evidence, the kind of assessment prosecutors would ordinarily make to determine whether to bring criminal charges. Mueller laid bare in granular detail a presidency plagued by paranoia and insecurity, depicting Trump's inner circle as gripped by fear of the president's spasms as he frantically pressured his aides to lie to the public and fabricate false records. Some of the episodes had previously been highlighted in news reports, but Mueller's report was singular for its definitive examination and revelatory details of the events, with the main actors under oath and on the record. Just as James Quarles had previewed to Barr on March 5th, the special counsel decided not to decide whether Trump committed a crime, based on his interpretation of the OLC opinion prohibiting the prosecution of a sitting president. Though it did not state so explicitly, the report suggested that Congress should assume the role of prosecutor. The conclusion that Congress may apply the obstruction laws to the president's corrupt exercise of the powers of office accords with our constitutional system of checks and balances and the principle that no person is above the law, the report stated. The report was classic Mueller, brimming with damning facts, but stripped of advocacy or judgment and devoid of a final conclusion. Many of the deeply investigated moments, retold almost as scenes in a movie, were engrossing, but the analysis of what to make of the president's conduct was written in overly legalistic prose, complete with double negatives. It was not clear what the facts added up to, nor did it provide a roadmap for Congress to pursue impeachment proceedings. For instance, the report stated, "If we had confidence after a thorough investigation of the facts that the president clearly did not commit obstruction of justice, we would so state. Based on the facts and the applicable legal standards, we are unable to reach that judgment." Mueller figured the American people and their elected representatives in Congress would read the report and decide whether and how to act. Thanks to Barr's notification to Congress, the media were on standby for breaking news. Cameras staked out the Attorney General outside his home in Virginia and the Justice Department's Washington headquarters. Barr and Rosenstein set a deadline for themselves of Sunday evening to report back to Congress with Mueller's principal conclusions, in part because they did not want the financial markets to open on Monday morning with only rumors in the media and the specter of criminal indictment hanging over the president. So they dug in to devour the report, staying up into the wee hours on Saturday morning to read. On Saturday, March 23rd, Barr, Rosenstein, and O'Callaghan reconvened at the office to hash out the report. They tried to weigh the evidence in Volume 2 and assumed, for the sake of argument, that each of the 10 episodes constituted obstruction of justice and first considered each one alone. They found the evidence truly disturbing, but felt they couldn't prove the president had corrupt intent. They asked themselves, could we get a criminal conviction on this evidence and survive an appeal? Their conclusion was unanimous, no. Their decision made, Barr, Rosenstein, and O'Callaghan had to decide how to announce it to the public. Ordinarily, a decision not to prosecute would remain confidential, but this was no ordinary case. The top Justice Department officials considered it an abomination that the Mueller investigation had become so public, but realized that because of the public scrutiny, they had to explain in detail what had happened, even though Trump was not being charged with or accused of a crime. Barr decided to write a second letter to Congress, which would detail the special counsel's principal conclusions. He and his team scanned the Mueller report looking for sentences that they could quote in the letter that summarized the special counsel's findings or reflected the bottom line. They found the report to be a garbled mess and struggled to find something worth quoting. At one point, O'Callaghan homed in on this line. "While this report does not conclude that the president committed a crime, it also does not exonerate him." "If we don't include that, people are going to criticize us," O'Callaghan said. Barr agreed. "You know what, Ed? That's a good point. Let's put that in there," he said. As they finalized the draft of the letter, O'Callaghan called Aaron Zebley, Mueller's chief of staff. He told Zebley that Barr would be laying out Mueller's bottom-line conclusions and asked if he would want to read the draft before it was released. Zebley responded no, telling O'Callaghan that they did not need to see it. Zebley was hoping and assuming that Barr's letter would quote the summaries the team had spent so much time on. But he didn't say that to O'Callaghan. Yet again, the Mueller team declined an opportunity to weigh in on how their investigation's findings would be presented to the public. At Mar-a-Lago, Trump awoke early on the morning of Sunday, March 24th. He got dressed in his golf shirt and khaki pants and headed out at about 9 o'clock to the Trump International Golf Club. He played a round of golf, ate lunch at the clubhouse, and chatted with friends. Giuliani was in Washington with the rest of Trump's personal legal team, but spoke by phone with the president regularly all weekend. He told the Washington Post's Robert Costa that Trump was in a watch-and-wait mode of cautious optimism. However, until you read the report, you don't know exactly what it entails, so you should keep your powder dry, Giuliani added. Trump told friends that weekend, "From everything I hear, it's good," but refrained from celebrating prematurely. As Kellyanne Conway remarked to Vice President Pence, "That's the business, man. That's somebody in real estate who knows the deal is not the deal until after it's notarized." Trump's team had prepared responses to a range of eventualities, with a worst-case scenario that the Mueller report could leak to the public unexpectedly and be so damaging with surprise evidence that it triggered an immediate impeachment inquiry in the House. The drafted response was exceedingly hard-hitting, a take-no-prisoners, blood-in-the-water jeremiad against Mueller, the FBI, and their methods. The president's personal lawyers gathered again on Sunday at Sekulow's office, wearing casual work clothes, with both Sekulow and Giuliani in bulky sweaters because it was chilly. A little after 3:15 p.m., Rabbit alerted Flood in Mar-a-Lago that within the hour, Barr would release the key takeaways from the report. He gave Flood the bottom line, but read aloud some key conclusory sections from Barr's letter. Flood and Cipollone then told Trump what to expect, and the president reached out to his personal legal team back in Washington. That afternoon, Barr made an announcement that would define how the world would interpret Mueller's findings. Barr submitted a 4-page letter to congressional leaders to, as he wrote, summarize the principal conclusions set out in the special counsel's report. The document was immediately released online. At Sekulow's office, Trump's lawyers sat in front of open laptops, impatiently waiting for the Barr letter to download. It was taking forever. The letter was already circulating among members of the press, who were texting and calling Trump's lawyers for reaction. John Santucci of ABC News was on one line asking for comment, and Sekulow, flustered by the slowness of his computer, admitted he hadn't been able to read a copy yet. "John, will you just send it to me?" he asked the journalist. Finally, the lawyers read it around the table. Barr wrote that the investigation found no evidence that any Trump campaign members or associates conspired or coordinated with the Russians to tilt the election. In essence, no collusion. On obstruction, he wrote that the special counsel had chosen not to reach a normal prosecutor's decision on whether Trump had committed a crime. The special counsel, therefore, did not draw a conclusion, one way or the other, as to whether the examined conduct constituted obstruction, Barr wrote. Instead, for each of the relevant actions investigated, the report sets out evidence on both sides of the question and leaves unresolved what the special counsel views as difficult issues of law and fact concerning whether the president's actions and intent could be viewed as obstruction. Barr explained he therefore concluded the evidence of obstruction was insufficient. In cataloging the president's actions, many of which took place in public view, the report identifies no actions that, in our judgment, constitute obstructive conduct. had a nexus to a pending or contemplated criminal proceeding, and were done with corrupt intent, Barr wrote. Barr's letter included the key line from Mueller's report that O'Callaghan had suggested adding in good faith that the report does not exonerate him. Nonetheless, Barr's letter laid the groundwork for Trump to declare otherwise. Barr had served his boss an unmistakable political victory, and a feeling of euphoria swept over Trump and his team. Jane Raskin snapped a picture on her phone that forever captures the moment they read Barr's summary of the report. Sitting at the conference table side by side, Giuliani grabbed Sekulow by the neck to give him a hug. They looked tired and relieved. Sekulow talked to Trump by phone. He was elated, but also very practical, asking about the team's media strategy. Of paramount importance to the president was the TV spin wars. "This is great," Trump said. "How are you all responding? Are you going out?" Trump wanted every television network to trumpet the news of his victory. Sekulow assured him that they had a detailed media plan. "This is very good news," Trump replied. "I'll see you tonight." Shortly before 5 p.m., Trump arrived by motorcade at Palm Beach International Airport for the two-hour flight home to Washington. He stood under the wing of Air Force One and offered his first reaction to the press corps. "There was no collusion with Russia. There was no obstruction, none whatsoever, and it was a complete and total exoneration." That night was a special memory for Trump's lawyers, who freshened up and assembled around dusk at the Yellow Oval Room in the second-floor residential quarters of the White House to give the president a homecoming. At 7:04 p.m., they watched Marine One land on the South Lawn. Trump stepped off the helicopter, dressed in a suit and red tie, and greeted the assembled press with a hearty wave. "This is a great country," he said. Inside the residence, Trump's defenders felt pride in their work during a tumultuous time when so many were rooting against them. Watching the ebullience of their clients strolling across the South Lawn, they felt a swell of relief. Trump walked upstairs and grinned as he saw his lawyers gathered around the room. He had two words for them: "Great job!" Trump, who is not a hugger, heartily shook every hand in the room. Sarah Sanders joined them for a moment of celebration and posed for a photo with Trump and his legal team, along with Flood and Cipollone, all of them beaming. Sekulow, the conductor and the heart of the operation, offered thanks to his partners. A year earlier, the president's legal team had endured a devastating stretch after John Dowd quit, and the president had no lead lawyer other than Sekulow. The team had to be recreated from scratch, and here they now all stood. "Thank you to you all," Sekulow told the group. "This was the best example of a team effort, where everybody brought their ideas to the table. It was a tremendous team effort, and I am grateful that our paths have crossed." Trump was well aware that there was more to come that would not be so flattering when some larger portion of the report would be released. But he was glad to have this phase behind him. He felt in the clear. He had won. The president offered his thanks, repeatedly saying, "Great job." The team knew that was the highest praise. "You're in good shape when he says, 'Great job.' You're not so good when he says, 'Let's see,'" one team member joked. The celebration ended with Trump's gentle goodnight. "All right, kids. Thanks," he said. What Barr included in his summary of principal conclusions, what he left out, and how he framed the special counsel's findings were the first and only words the public received that month about the probe's long-awaited conclusion. Inside the bunker of Mueller's lawyers, Barr's letter stung. Members of the special counsel team would later describe Mueller's reaction. He looked as if he'd been slapped. Some team members were livid at what they considered Barr's calculated and selective word choices that sidestepped the unpleasant evidence the team had uncovered about Trump himself and his campaign's encouragement of the Russians. The team had made groundbreaking discoveries about Russian bots and intelligence officers rushing to hack Clinton's personal emails hours after Trump's "Russia, if you're listening" remarks. Yet that work was reduced to less than a sentence in Barr's letter. Even the portion of the dependent clause in that sentence that Barr chose to make public put Trump in the most flattering light. Quoting from the report, Barr wrote that the investigation did not establish that the members of the Trump campaign conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in its election interference activities. He left out the 39 preceding words from that passage, which confirmed the very facts Trump hated to acknowledge and refused to hear. Although the investigation established that the Russian government perceived it would benefit from a Trump presidency and worked to secure that outcome, and that the campaign expected it would benefit electorally from information stolen and released through Russian efforts. The authors of Volume 2, who struggled to reveal every detail of Trump's moves to shut down or curtail the criminal investigation, practically had steam coming out of their ears. Barr's letter appeared to the uninformed reader to say the opposite of what they painstakingly laid out in their report. For example, Barr wrote that none of Trump's actions, in our judgment, were done with corrupt intent. Actually, the report's authors had detailed 4 episodes in which they identified substantial evidence of Trump's intent to thwart the probe. What had once been Trump's defiant mantra of "no collusion, no obstruction" instantly became a rallying cry for his re-election, lines he and his surrogates repeated on every media platform. Never mind what the Mueller team actually had found. Trump was winning the spin war. Mueller had himself to blame for the misrepresentation of his work, in that he was a by-the-books creature of bureaucratic norms miscast for the Trump era, a period of profound polarization, fraying institutions and news delivered like an IV to the public in fits and spurts. "We're the Twitter Society," said Frank Figliuzzi, a former Mueller colleague at the FBI. "We're the Digital Streaming Society. We're the Scan the Headlines to Get Some News Society." That's not Mueller. That's not a 400-page report. Somebody's got to show their face on a TV screen and scream and yell. What many of us have asked is, in the age of Trump, as steadfast as Mueller's been to the principles of democracy that got us here, has Mueller served us well with this style? The answer is no. On the morning of March 25th, less than 24 hours after Barr sent his summary letter, Zebley contacted O'Callaghan. He asked that the Justice Department release the executive summaries from each volume of Mueller's report. O'Callaghan was noncommittal and said he, Barr, and Rosenstein would think about it. O'Callaghan asked Zebley to mark up the summaries for all necessary redactions of sensitive grand jury material and send them back. Later that day, Zebley called O'Callaghan with a complaint. He said there was public confusion in the media reporting about Barr's letter. When O'Callaghan briefed Barr on the call, the attorney general was taken aback and a bit peeved. As Barr saw it, he had written the letter to be intentionally brief and include only Mueller's baseline conclusions. And, as an act of good faith, he quoted Mueller's language about not being able to exonerate the president. What's more, Barr told his team, they had given Mueller and his deputies an opportunity to review a draft of the letter, and Zebley declined. How could Zebley now be upset about it? On March 27th, Mueller signed a letter to Barr from the special counsel's office, objecting strongly to the attorney general's handling of the principal conclusions. The summary letter the department sent to Congress and released to the public late in the afternoon of March 24th did not fully capture the context, nature, and substance of this office's work and its conclusions. We communicated that concern to the department on the morning of March 25th. There is now public confusion about critical aspects of the results of our investigation. This threatens to undermine a central purpose for which the department appointed the special counsel, to assure full public confidence in the outcome of the investigations. The letter said that the introductions and executive summaries of the report accurately summarized this office's work and conclusions and included those redacted documents as attachments. Release at this time would alleviate the misunderstandings that have arisen and would answer congressional and public questions about the nature and outcome of our investigation. Barr's office did not receive the letter until March 28th. When they first read it, the Attorney General and his team thought, "Holy shit, what is this? Give us a break." To them, it was an uncharacteristically passive-aggressive move by Mueller. On April 30th, the eve of Barr's Senate testimony, the correspondence was reported by Devlin Barrett and Matt Zapatosky of The Washington Post. At his hearing the next day, Barr characterized the letter's tone as snitty and speculated that it was written by one of Mueller's underlings. As he first absorbed the letter in private on March 28th, Barr was pissed. He thought the letter was nasty, and he felt betrayed by his friend. "I'm calling Bob," Barr told his staff. "We'll work this out." Mueller was out of the office getting a haircut that morning, but they connected later, shortly before lunchtime. Listening in from the Justice Department were Rosenstein, O'Callaghan, and Rabbit. "What the hell, Bob?" Barr asked. "What's up with this letter? Why didn't you pick up the phone and call me?" Mueller replied by saying something along the lines of, "We have concerns that certain issues were not given their full context. The executive summaries are the precise information necessary to reach the conclusion. There's not something that's absolutely wrong with your letter. The problem is misrepresentations in the media. We need to get something out soon that is more accurate, to clarify things." Despite his well-established lack of interest in public relations, Mueller zeroed in on the media coverage of his report. He said something along the lines of, "We have concerns that our report is losing its impact because the full story's not out there and the media is not covering it the way we want them to." "This is supposed to be confidential," Barr told Mueller. Barr said the department was moving quickly to prepare the report for public release, but explained that there would be an unwanted gap of time as a consequence of the report's being 448 pages and not containing the necessary redactions. "To be clear, we're not trying to summarize the work. We're just giving the principal conclusions," Barr told Mueller. "We offered you the opportunity to look at the letter, and you said no. We're flabbergasted here." "Your summary letter fails to put into context the decisions we made," Mueller said. At this point, Zebley jumped in. He had no problems with Barr's description of their Russian interference work and said nothing about it. "It's all about obstruction. Your letter doesn't give enough context as to our thinking about the OLC opinion, and the media coverage is misleading about that." Barr again defended his letter. "We weren't trying to summarize. We weren't trying to put in context. We were just trying to state your conclusions," he told Mueller and Zebley. The temperature started to come down. Mueller asked how long it would be until the report was released in full, and Barr said they were aiming for mid-April. Mueller then made another pitch for issuing the executive summaries. "We've had a really good relationship with you so far, and we're asking you to do this, and we'd like it to happen sooner rather than later," Mueller said. Barr replied, "I'd prefer to push forward and get it all done. I don't think putting it out piecemeal is good." The attorney general said he thought issuing the summaries would cause even more confusion than was already in the body politic. "Thanks for entertaining the request," Mueller said. "I appreciate it. We really just want full disclosure." The call ended on an uplifting note. "At the end of the day, you're part of the Department of Justice," Barr said. "I agree," Mueller replied. "We're all in the department together," Barr said. "We'll get back to you." That night, Mueller's team considered putting out a press statement of their own, explaining their objections to Barr's four-page letter, but decided against it. For the rest of the day and into the next morning, Barr, together with Rosenstein, O'Callaghan, and Rabbit, debated Mueller's request. They nearly decided to release the executive summaries, but opted against it for the reasons Barr articulated on the call with Mueller. The report was lengthy, nuanced, and confusing, and Barr worried that people would pick apart the summaries and draw misleading conclusions. Barr and his team regretted having used the word "summarize" in the March 24th letter. They also lamented that Trump was claiming that Mueller had totally exonerated him. That was false, but Barr decided not to publicly correct his boss. The president's lawyers understood the truth, too. A lot of iceberg remained under the water, but they could do little to wean their client off his talking points. On March 29th, Barr decided to write another letter to congressional leaders to clear up his intentions. "My March 24th letter was not, and did not purport to be, an exhaustive recounting of the special counsel's investigation or report." He added, "Everyone will soon be able to read it on their own. I do not believe it would be in the public's interest for me to attempt to summarize the full report or to release it in serial or piecemeal fashion." Barr intended this letter to be a warning shot to Congress and the media, but also to Mueller's angry prosecutors, to calm down, stop jumping to conclusions, and be patient. There was a lot more still to see.